have these new drugs that are life-saving and prevent kidney failure and heart attacks, and it's not any good if people can't take them for the long term.
There's this sea of cardiovascular disease that kills people, and those that make it through that to reach the outcome of kidney failure is such a rare thing, and you see it just loud and clear.
CKM is the next frontier that we're approaching from a multidisciplinary standpoint in our field.
Welcome to the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Matthew Sparks, and this episode is all about the new cardiovascular kidney metabolic syndrome. Today, we have two authors from a paper in Kidney 360 titled Experience and Outcome of a Dedicated Cardio-Nephrology Service, A Step Toward Integrated CKM Syndrome Care. The first author is Dr. Karen Diwolski, who's here with us today, along with the senior author, Dr. Nisha Bansal, both from the University of Washington. Welcome to the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast.
My name is Karen Diwolski. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Washington. I did my training here at the University of Washington, and I'm originally a Massachusetts native. And in my free time outside of work, which I always emphasize to the fellows that they need to keep their hobbies outside of work, I spend a lot of time on my bike.
My name is Nisha Bansal. I'm a professor here at the University of Washington in the Division of Nephrology. I also am the director of the Kidney Heart Service, which you'll be hearing a little bit more about.
First, I guess we can talk about the evolution of this service. When did it start? What were the pressures that were surrounding it?
So the service was launched in 2020 formally, although discussions around the launching of the service, of course, happened prior to that. It was created in response to really an increasing need for dedicated nephrology care for cardiac patients at the University of Washington. We have a really very complex cardiology service here with heart transplants, many mechanical circulatory support devices, and that's only been really increasing here as the hospital and that focus has expanded, and it became fairly clear that the nephrology needs of those patients oftentimes were more specialized. In response to that, the Kidney Heart Service, which was launched in 2020 with a dedicated team of nephrologists. At the time, 2 to 3 nephrologists who essentially served almost entirely on that service in an alternating manner where they could develop the specialized expertise to see those patients.
The Kidney Heart Service really launched in response to the volume of patients we were seeing with concomitant kidney and heart disease and the very poor outcomes we were seeing in those patients. We looked at our internal hospital data and we found that amongst patients, for example, admitted with heart failure, 3/4 of them had acute kidney injury. And amongst those who had acute kidney injury, they had 3-fold higher risk of mortality, length of stay, and hospital readmissions. We also saw high rates of de novo dialysis initiation amongst this population. And we felt with the growing complexity of both on the nephrology side and the cardiology side, that there was a need for sub-specialized care to keep up and to provide better care for these patients. And it was a challenging time, to be honest. Launching in 2020 was during the COVID pandemic, and the planning into launching the service certainly preceded that. And we made the decision to go ahead with the launch. In fact, we were seeing more patients who had concomitant kidney and heart disease because of the timing of the launch of the service. And it is certainly true that we launched the service before the CKM syndrome was coined. But I think any nephrologist can tell you the recognition that kidney disease and heart disease frequently occur together is not new. We've known that for decades. And if anything, we are grateful that the CKM syndrome has brought increased attention to the importance of kidney disease in this syndrome.
Before we understand a little bit about the data, can talk a little bit more about how the service was prior and then what happened when you changed.
Prior to the service launching, the consult service for nephrology was essentially a general nephrology consult service. And any patient from a cardiology service or cardiac surgery service who needed a nephrology consult would go to that service. And it was typically overseen by an attending and 2 fellows. There is additionally another subspecialized service, the University of Washington, specifically for liver patients, which was separate from that. So that was the model going in to launching the Kidney Heart Service, was 1 general nephrology attending and 2 fellows, and then a separate attending only kidney liver service. And so the Kidney Heart Service was launched in conjunction with this model where another attending-only service was added to have three total services in the hospital seeing different nephrology patients.
Is the attending-only service with occasional fellow, or is that how it works?
It was initially launched as an attending-only service, and then about 7 months into its launch, so after it had kind of gotten its feet on the ground in terms of figuring out the mechanics of the service, we started having fellows rotating on it about half the time.
And how many patients are generally on the service?
Mean is 12 to 15, although there can certainly be fluctuations well above that and sometimes below that.
And the service traverses both floor and ICU?
Yes, it traverses any patient in the hospital who's on a primary cardiology or cardiac surgery service. So that can include the cardiothoracic ICU, the CCU, the CICU, as well as any acute cardiology floor.
What are some of the challenges that were faced and issues that had to be traversed in order for this to be successful?
Probably the most clear challenge is just having the staffing to do the service. You need to have at least 2 to 3 attendings who have the dedicated time to be on a kidney heart service. So there needs to be bandwidth from the nephrology service and the support of the hospital and the nephrology division in order to have a service like this, because it is like fairly resource intensive in terms of attending time, as well as potentially fellow time. As the service developed, there was also challenges around just incorporating, changing the model of how we're doing consults in the hospital. So of course, going from it being a general nephrology service where the attendings are trading off frequently to having it be dedicated nephrologists serving the cardiology patients. I think people adapting to that over time, of course, poses some challenges just in restructuring, although I think ultimately that actually became a strength of the service.
One of the benefits of this is that you and your group went and got the data, and I love that. In the end, it's hard to understand how something functions without data. So maybe tell us a little bit about sort of the paper and the methods for how your group compared what was happening prior and then after the institution of this service.
Yeah, so a few years into the service, we kind of looking back at it, it seemed grossly like we were having maybe better outcomes, or at least certainly from a subjective standpoint, better relationships were being developed between services from a multidisciplinary standpoint. And we wanted to see what patients are we actually taking care of? What is the cohort look like demographically, severity of illness, length of stay? It certainly seemed like there were a lot of patients in the ICU that we were taking care of, but what did that actually look like in practice? So we looked at the first 31 months of the service, which was essentially up to the point where we were looking at data to when the Kidney Heart Service had launched, other than the first 7 months of the launch, because there had been a change in the hospital-wide electronic medical record that actually prevented us from directly looking at the data in that first 7 months. So we collated all the data from the first 31 months of patients, so any patient that had been seen by a Kidney Heart Service attending, and looked using a combination of both physician chart review to look at granular topics like why were we being consulted, aspects that can be a little bit challenging to ascertain just from coding, and then more objective data such as creatinine trends, weight trends, ICU stays, length of stays, which we were able to pull from the chart with the help of our Epic analyst. We then wanted to see, was there any difference between this and patients that were previously seen in the hospital, cardiac patients that had previously been seen in the hospital with nephrology consults. So we looked back at old data from prior to the launch of the Kidney Heart Service for any patient that had been on a cardiology service or cardiac surgery service and had a nephrology consult. And we collated a certain amount of objective data about those patients. Unfortunately, there was a major limitation in this, in that the EMR had changed in between, and the old data from prior to the initiation of the Kidney Heart Service was in this old kind of defunct record that is no longer active. So it really limited how much granularity we could get out of that data. But we were able to at least look at demographics, length of stay outcomes, and some other aspects of the hospital stay, and then compare the two. There's, of course, a huge caveat that there are many confounders here, and we weren't really able to control in the way we ideally would have. So I would certainly advocate for a lot of caution with overinterpreting the comparisons between the outcomes of the two patient cohorts. But we, I think, at least were able to see the trends and whether some of these trends were meaningful in the context of all of these limitations.
Were there any patient characteristics that surprised you when you looked at the data?
I don't think I was particularly surprised by the patients' characteristics, just based on our experience with patients in the hospital that we were taking care of. The mean age, for example, was around 63, which seemed approximately accurate for the patients we were taking care of. And about a third of them had dialysis dependents coming in, so end-stage kidney disease coming in, and that seemed about what I would have expected. I think we all expected to see very high rates of ICU length of stay, relatively high length of stay for a lot of these patients, and relatively high morbidity and mortality, unfortunately, which we did see. So I don't think there is anything overwhelmingly surprising about the demographic data or in many ways the various other aspects of their hospital courses that we were able to ascertain.
One thing I'm thinking about is, wow, this is a very sick population. 30% already have stage 3 CKD, 60 AKI, long length of stay. I'm curious if you could make a meaningful impact, you could save a lot of money and lives and hospital stay. Was there any attempt to look at that aspect of this? And I'm thinking about this as a way to show the value of nephrology.
We didn't run formal financial quantification on anything just because of many of the limitations that we had in the data, but we did look at several markers that we thought might be meaningful to show to hospital leadership and specific to a nephrology perspective. So, for example, one element of that was dialysis rates and AKI. So coming into launching the Kidney Heart Service, one of the drivers of this was that it felt like we were being very frequently asked to UF patients with diuretic resistant heart failure. And from a nephrology perspective, it felt like there may be an opportunity to reduce that rate if we were involved earlier in care and could help optimize diuretics, optimize hemodynamics, and potentially avoid some renal replacement therapies. And so one of the outcomes that we looked at was rate of dialysis in AKI patients. And we did show that the rate was technically a bit lower than it had been prior to the Kidney Heart Service. And that does save the hospital some money. So having less dialysis in your patient population, of course, is less resource intensive for these patients. So that was one outcome that we looked at where we potentially had a positive impact. We did also look at length of stay, which actually we found a longer length of stay in the more modern cohort, and mortality was lower. So overall, I think some of the things the hospital cares about, we showed that there may be some benefit, or at least our service was correlating to some improved outcomes. The length of stay being longer, of course, was one area that I think there's a lot of ways we could look at that and analyze that further in terms of why that might be true. And I think it goes beyond anything the Kidney Heart Service was doing to just general high complexity of patients, higher rates of MCS, heart transplant, and potentially other limitations by the COVID pandemic, et cetera.
We did see that perhaps there's a trend towards less need for dialysis initiation for these patients. And we did, in the paper, do some preliminary economic analysis using national data about cost savings for this. On average, a single dialysis session in the hospital is estimated about $1,000 per session. And so this could certainly have economic savings. And we have gone to hospital leadership to share this data to get ongoing support for the service. And so those discussions are in process and happening.
Like, you almost want to like have a normalization variable. Look at another condition in the same period of time to see if you can normalize it. Really impressed with the AKI dialysis. And one of the real gold nuggets in this manuscript is the diuretic protocol. Can you tell me about how that came about? And I think I love this because it seems like it's something all nephrologists inherently are doing in their head, but all are probably different in how they're implementing it. So how did this come about and how has it changed the practice in one, the initial prescription of diuretics? And I really love the adjunctive therapies, more standardized approach to it. So I'd love to hear more about that.
We recognized there was a lot of heterogeneity in terms of the way that we were approaching diuretic management. And truly, if you think about diuretic resistance, in my mind, it's a kidney problem. Diuretics work through the kidney. And we realized quite quickly that there was not a real complete shared understanding of diuretic mechanisms and how they can be used synergistically to achieve effective naturesis and diuresis. And so we actually built upon a protocol that was previously developed by one of our cardiology colleagues based on the CARES trial. And then we took a kind of contemporary view of it. We worked collaboratively with our heart failure cardiologists to modify and update the protocol with several different additions. One is that we thought about how we should start diuretics, what the initial dosing should be, the frequency should be, and the route of administration. Second, we thought about the adjunctive therapies and how to layer those on. And that took a little bit of work, to be honest, but it was exciting because there's been a lot of new data on combination diuretic therapies from new clinical trials that really guided our management. And so it's looking carefully at electrolytes and other markers to determine how to layer on these adjunctive therapies to achieve sequential nephron blockade. And third, the other addition we made was adding objective markers to guide naturesis and diuresis. And I think the biggest addition we made was thinking beyond just weights and net eyes and nose, but adding urine spodiums on. And we find this is a really great marker that you can measure, 1 to 2 hours after giving a diuretic dose to assess natriuretic response versus losing an entire day and looking in 24 hours, oh, was there effective diuresis for the patient? And so it was a very iterative process. And in fact, we've now on version 3.0 of the diuretic protocol. So we continue to iterate it. And in addition, we've created an Epic algorithm as part of the diuretic protocol. So it's now part of our Epic order set. So any provider in the hospital, actually across our entire health system, can pull up the diuretic protocol and use it. And we have prompts in there of when nephrology should be consulted as well.
I totally agree. The spot urine sodium has been so helpful, but it has not caught on like I would have had imagined it would. And with the challenges and weights and 24-hour urine collection, it's a great adjunctive maneuver for patients. So love to see that in there.
I think it's fascinating that in 2026, no matter what hospital you're at, you still can't get an accurate weight or an accurate eyes and nose. It's amazing to me. So urine sodium has really changed our practice.
And I would say I've noticed that a lot more teams are ordering it without us being involved. As in when we get consulted, they've already been tracking urine sodiums for some time. So it does seem like the diuretic protocol and the Kidney Heart Service, I think more at large, has led to more uptake of this, which has been great to see.
I wonder if this sort of approach also could diminish consult numbers too. If you teach this and share this to other service lines, could help in earlier decongestion and really supplant the need for nephrology to see every single patient. Is that something that y'all have seen or tracked with this data?
Yeah, that's a great question. We haven't necessarily tracked it formally at this point. I think from a sort of subjective observational standpoint, it does feel like we are being consulted probably less for some of the diuretic management than we used to, because I think a lot of these providers are becoming more familiar and more comfortable with managing more complex diuresis on their own. So I think it's pretty likely that there has been a change in trend and potentially a decrease in the number of consults as a result of this, although I don't necessarily have the objective data to support that. Just observationally, it does seem like that's what's been happening, which I think is probably a good thing. Everyone in the hospital, we have so many sick patients to manage. And I think empowering more people from different teams and specialties to do this type of management is a really excellent forward thinking approach that I think has led to probably better care and earlier care and more aggressive care for a lot of these patients.
I just want to hear about the experience that this service has had with developing POCUS for volume assessment.
The nephrology attendings who have been on this service as the primary attendings all had some degree of specialized training in POCUS, and there's been some ongoing studies also on the use of VEXAS, which I think Nisha could probably speak to at a little bit more detail. So trying to develop some specialized expertise in POCUS for volume assessments has certainly been an ongoing area of training for the kidney heart attendings. And then, so onto the fellows. And I think truly developing a POCUS curriculum is an ongoing area of development to really figure out what's the best way to approach this so that fellows are learning it from a nephrology standpoint, especially because a lot of fellows are coming in with probably more exposure to it than nephrology attendings have had traditionally because residencies are so focused on it currently. But POCUS has certainly been an important element of our volume assessments, especially in patients who don't have any other kind of dedicated, like we have a lot of PACs, for example, in our patients. So you'd kind of know they're filling pressures at all times or they're getting very frequent invasive monitoring. But if we don't have that available, especially for patients who are in the acute care service, we certainly do use POCUS.
Yeah, I think this is really incredible to see, like really just putting this into motion and an important aspect. Maybe we can wrap up now and talk about CKM and how this wraps together in the entire sort of bundle of care with CKM. We're talking about both inpatient and outpatient. How do we look at this as a field and move forward?
So CKM, of course, is the next frontier that we're approaching from a multidisciplinary standpoint in our field and the field of cardiovascular medicine and endocrinology. And I think moving forward, it's really imperative that nephrologists embrace and tackle this in this multidisciplinary way and figuring out the best ways to do that with that approach in mind, as again, this syndrome we know affects such a high percentage of Americans and patients worldwide. You know, trying to think of ways to do this from an inpatient versus outpatient or combined approach is, of course, very important. And I think that the Kidney Heart Service provides one avenue of thinking about it from an inpatient approach. So recognizing that none of our specialties are existing in isolation and all of these organ systems are affecting each other. And how do we work with our cardiology colleagues and potentially other specialty, subspecialty colleagues, depending on the scenario, to best move patient care forward and improve it over time. So I think that this service was founded in recognition of that syndrome, even before it had a name per se, but recognizing that cardiorenal syndrome is very present in these patients and requires this more holistic and multidisciplinary approach to care. I think that the Kidney Heart Service can serve as a model for the appropriate setting, depending on, again, a hospital's need, a patient population need, is one potential approach to incorporate that team-based approach to helping patients with cardiac disease, kidney disease, the combination of the two, improve their outcomes, decrease their length of stay, hopefully, improve their morbidity and mortality, and ultimately, hopefully, their lives as we move forward with their care.
I think it's well said. And I really commend your group for putting this together. And I think it's a model for all of us to strive to. It's what I love to read, the literature. You always find interesting ideas to take from other institutions. And I think everywhere as a nephrologist, always try to teach the fellows, is, you know, share what you're doing. So important. And I think now is a great time. I almost see the future of not having a consult service, but just having the nephrologist on the team. Seems like that's where we're getting very close to that. I saw that the service was consulted like first day of admission for most patients. So it appears that for many patients, they are just part of the team.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it oftentimes feels like we are very much a primary member of the team and we're driving or at least guiding much of their care. And with these patients, we're aspects of their volume management and kidney function are just so paramount to their outcomes, and not just their outcomes, but potentially their candidacy for more advanced treatments or advanced heart failure therapies, and thinking about their kidney function within that. I think it's just so essential that nephrology is involved. And I do think that this service has clearly shown itself to help increase that involvement and potentially make it more impactful.
What are some last words about this service, CKM in general, and mainly focused on the inpatient care of patients with both kidney and cardiovascular disease?
We're excited to share this one model of integrated care. I do think that we're at a critical time in nephrology and in cardiovascular care, where we're seeing a lot of convergence in our therapies coming together. And to me, that's a sign that there's shared biology and a need for shared clinical care of these patients. And so this is one model in which we can really achieve the goals of what the CKM statement actually set out to do, which was develop integrated care models. And I think this is one model that could work at some centers, and we've had some success with it here.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bansal and Dr. Dybulski. We really appreciate your time, your contributions to the literature, and thank you to the listeners to the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. talking about cardiovascular outcomes in SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists. This paper, published in JASN, titled Comparative Effectiveness of SGLT2 Inhibitors and GLP-1 Receptor Agonists on Kidney and Cardiovascular Outcomes by Kidney Failure Risk. We are joined by the first author, Dr. Sydney Hartzell, and we're also joined by the senior author, Dr. Srini Badu. Thank you both so much for coming. Love to get to know both of you. First, we'll start with Dr. Hartzell.
Hi, I'm Sydney Hartzell. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Utah. I'm a general nephrologist and physician scientist, and my research is centered on treatment optimization in CKM syndrome.
Welcome. Happy to have you on. And Dr. Badu.
I am Srini Badu. I'm professor of internal medicine, and I am a co-director of the Cardiovascular Metabolism Center at the University of Utah.
It's an unusual fight. Two drugs that all nephrologists love, both especially SGLT2 inhibitors, our first love, and now GLP-1 receptor agonist. And so I was looking at the visual abstract, and it does kind of look like it's a fight between the Gila monster and the apple tree. So let's talk a little bit about how this started and what the idea was to compare both these drugs.
I wouldn't say we thought of it so much as a fight. It's just that right now, with drug accessibility being difficult for both of these medications, which can be expensive, there are several guidelines, the 2025 ADA guidelines and the most recent joint CKM guidelines, that suggest either SGLT2 or GLP-1 for certain patients with type 2 diabetes and particular risk profiles. But the clinician isn't really left with a lot of guidance as to which one to choose when. So we thought that was a sort of a hole in practice that needed to be addressed. And there's currently not any randomized control trials comparing these two together.
And also, I see it's done through the VA, which also maybe helps your study in that less barriers for actually accessing the drugs. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah. The VA is a really powerful data source for research on medications because their drugs are provided at low or no cost to veterans. So although there are definitely still demographic and financial barriers for people, that source of confounding is a little bit minimized in this VA data set.
Well, maybe we'll talk more about this later. When I think about the decision for both or one or the other, it sometimes stems around factors that, like, for instance, you can't take an SGLT2 inhibitor because of whatever reason, or you've had an adverse event from that drug. And for the GLP-1 receptor agonists, just the same sort of thing, is that maybe they tried the drug and couldn't take it. So how do you make sure that some of those factors are not confounding some of the data here?
That's why we are trying to do an active compare new user design study, looking at trying to balance the baseline risk factors across the groups with inverse priority weighting and trying to minimize confounding.
Basically, and trying to set the stage so that it's apples to apples comparison, like two patients almost identical in profiles, which one would work better?
That is the kind of the statistical approach that we are taking with this.
Let's talk about the methodology. We already mentioned the VA was used. How did you gather this data and then move forward to answer these questions?
We put together a data set, national VA cohort of 2.5 million veterans with type 2 diabetes. The basic goal is to do comparative effectiveness studies in that data set. And so we have been using that for publishing papers and comparing STL, GLP-1, intra-class comparisons, etc. And this is one of the papers that Sydney led, and looking at comparing the SGLT with GLP-1, kidney outcome in particular, kidney failure being the focus. There is a lot of emphasis on the CKM syndrome correctly, and we do need to look at the CKM composite, which is a composite of cardiovascular event or kidney event. But the point there is that the cardiovascular events are about 10 times more than the kidney event. And when somebody starts looking at the CKM composite, then the kidney outcome gets swamped. So that's why we wanted to focus on the kidney failure. We are nephrologists, and we shouldn't forget that, and kidney is important. And that's why we are focusing on the kidney failure as an outcome, and also looking at kidney failure risk as an effect modifier of the the comparative effectiveness?
The statistical methods in this paper were really kind of the meat of it, and it was a big project. And I just want to emphasize that, like, yes, I'm the first author, but it was completely a team effort. And we have, like, every single person listed on this paper had such an integral role. And we have biostatisticians and epidemiologists and cardiologists and nephrologists, and it was a team effort.
Some of the challenges in administrative database, as you already mentioned, is trying to equal the playing field, remove the confounders that might be making the decision as to why a provider would choose one or the other. And some of the big ones, there's, for instance, uncontrolled diabetes. You might reach for a GLP-1 over an SGLT2 inhibitor. So maybe we can talk about that as we go through this, but how do you even the playing field so that it is an apples to apples comparison when talking about these two drugs? Because I can see potentially how you might be reaching more to a GLP-1 in somebody who has a lot more advanced diabetes, more obese, and maybe the GLP-1 might be in more low-risk individuals, potentially. I'm not sure. Maybe that's also an interesting thing that you guys will look at here.
So what you're getting at is the indication bias. In an observational study, when we are looking at people getting started on different agents, and we are trying to compare those two, the basic question is, why did people, some people get started on SGLT2, why some people on GLP-1? And what drive those decisions by the physicians as well as the patients. So the indication bias is a big issue in these kind of studies. And the way we try to address is to look at all the different factors that are related to them, starting one drug versus other, and develop the propensity score, and then do inverse probability weighting. Basically, we are trying to get a cohort which is similar in the two groups. So that's indication bias, and that's what we are trying to do here.
Maybe we can move on to the methodology and then table one to look at the baseline characteristics. And if I'm hearing this correctly, basically you have a lot of patients. We might whittle it down to only include those that are most similar to each other. Is that sort of how the propensity matching would work?
If we do propensity matching, that would be correct. That's what, but this is propensity weighting. And what this does is to create a population, a statistical population, which is similar between the two drug groups based on the baseline characteristics. That's what inverse probability weighting does. So it doesn't whittle the group down. And that's the advantage of using the weighting versus matching.
And you can see that in table one. If you look at the pre-weighted populations, you see differences at baseline between those assigned to SGLT2s and GLP-1s that you'd sort of expect. And then after weighting, those populations look more similar to each other.
So what are some of the things that were different at baseline that then evened out that we should know about?
Those started on a GLP-1 were at a higher BMI at baseline. And those started on an SGLT2 had more cardiovascular disease at baseline.
And so now after this propensity weighting, those now became similar. Can you just explain how that works?
I hate to use this terminology, but what it actually does is the statisticians and the methodologists call it pseudo-population. So from the baseline characteristics, from the weight, it generates a population which actually is much larger than the study cohort and generates a population in which the baseline characteristics are matched. The more important thing is how we want to check whether matching worked. Is apart from looking at the table, if you also look at the balance plots in the supplement, so it looks at the standardized mean difference. If the two groups are well matched, and the standardized mean difference should be close to zero. And between minus 0.1 to plus 0.1, difference is considered acceptable. And in the balance plots that we presented, as you can see, after weighting, the groups are well balanced across the different subgroups and different analyses that we did.
I noticed also there's the insulin glargine group added as well. My guess is that a control?
It's a positive control. The point is almost all of the randomized controlled trials in SGLT GLP-1, they're against placebo. So we do want to have a control group here, which we expect to do worse compared to either of the two. So we included the insulin glargine as a positive control so that we can interpret whether the data makes sense.
Let's move on to figure two and get to some results. I found that figure very fascinating. Can you talk about what you showed in that figure?
So what this figure is showing is kidney failure as an all-cause death. And whenever we talk about kidney failure, which is a rare event, okay, our nephrologists, we think it's extremely common because that's what we see day in and day out. But if you look at a larger type of diabetes population, kidney failure is a rare event, and death is much more common. So there is always a competing risk of death whenever we are talking about a non-fatal event, more so for a rare event. And what you're seeing there is at the bottom is a kidney failure. We are just looking at it and comparing the insulin glargine GLP-1 SGLT2. And two, even there appears to be as the lowest risk of incidence of cumulative incidence of kidney failure. Insulin glargine appears to be a little bit worse, but not much worse. But when you also look at death that happens before kidney failure, that's what the top lines are there. And there you can pretty clearly see that a lot of people on insulin glargine die before they develop kidney failure. In other words, the kidney failure risk that you're seeing with insulin glargine is underestimated because of the competing risk of death.
We teach this all the time about how there's this sea of cardiovascular disease that kills people, and those that make it through that to reach the outcome of kidney failure is such a rare thing, and you see it just loud and clear, where the little kidney failure line is tucked away at the bottom. And in fact, you can really hardly see a separation, but I'm sure if you didn't change the scale, it would appear that those were larger than they are. But the death before kidney failure just far shadows it. And so I think this is where maybe we as nephrologists are having this moment where we're finally saying, okay, when we're seeing a patient, we really need to focus on cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, and that's the panel B on the figure there, where you can see the MACE actually is higher than all-cause death before MACE. So cardiovascular events are driving a lot of what's happening in this type 2 diabetes population.
This is where it's hard to consider this, but if you have type 2 diabetes, like maybe these are just drugs you need to be on, instead of waiting for end organ damage like albuminuria, because the cat's out of the bag at that point. But these are really great illustrations of that. And I really particularly like the addition of the insulin glargine because it helps to anchor the data so that you really see it in its true form.
The CKM composite, which was both kidney failure events and MACE together, is really driven by those MACE events. People with type 2 diabetes who are at risk of kidney disease have cardiovascular events. That's what drives their outcomes. But as nephrologists, that's why we wanted to focus on the kidney failure as the primary outcome, which is often overshadowed by those cardiovascular events, but is still really important for patients.
So if you look at like figure A, where the kidney failure is so low, you can almost see why the CKM composite almost looks identical to MACE because it's such a low event rate.
I think that's an extremely important point. With all the excitement of CKM syndrome, if we just focus on CKM composite and not pay attention to the kidney outcome itself, then it could be driven entirely by cardiovascular events. You can think of a drug which may cause kidney damage but still protect the heart. Then if we just go by the CKM composite, we'll say that's a great drug, but it may actually be causing kidney damage. So it's possible. CKM is an interesting concept. We should be excited about it, and we should be all for it. But there are caveats to that. We should always focus on the kidneys. That should be important for us.
Let's move on to figure three.
So figure three in the entire cohort of veterans with type 2 diabetes who are on baseline metformin, most of these patients were a lower kidney failure risk, but this includes everyone. And really the highlight here is in the MACE and the CKM composite outcomes, where GLP-1s performed better than SGLT2 for protection against cardiovascular events or that cardiovascular kidney failure composite. Kidney failure, although not statistically different, there was this sort of moderate signal that maybe SGLT2s were more protective than GLP-1s for kidney failure events. But again, that wasn't significant, just sort of something to note as we move forward in research. And then the two performed equally for all-cause death protection.
So to summarize that, the GLP-1 seemed to favor more of a cardiovascular protection, whereas SGLT2 inhibitor, we can't say definitively, leaning a little bit more towards a kidney failure, but not a slam dunk on that.
So even the SGLT2, the confidence interval does lean towards non-significance. The point estimate between, say, the SGLT and GLP-1 for MACE versus kidney failure, the point estimates are kind of comparable. Again, kidney failure is a rare event, so the fewer events. So I do think SGLT2 are more effective for kidney outcome and GLP-1 more for cardiovascular. That's how I would interpret it. There are a lot of papers written on the fallacy of p-values.
And again, just to remind the readers, this is not a randomized controlled trial, but a good faith effort to try to compare these two drugs in a large cohort.
Yeah. Exactly. On the MACE and CKM composite outcomes with GLP-1s being favored, that is different than existing thought of SGLT2 versus GLP-1s. However, this observational study, we excluded exendin-based GLP-1s, which in the literature haven't shown a strong cardiovascular or kidney protection signal. So a lot of the current guidelines and literature includes those older agents than exenatide and lixexenatide. So this one is human analog GLP-1s. And I think mostly this finding sort of should give us all pause and really highlight the need for a randomized control trial focusing on human analog GLP-1s versus SGLT2s whenever you're considering their cardiovascular kidney performance.
Well, the next figure I really like as well, because we use kidney failure risk equations so often.
So figure 4, I think, is probably the single most important takeaway of this paper. So what we did is we stratified the population by their baseline kidney failure risk using the kidney failure risk equation, or KFRE. So those with a low risk had less than 2% five-year risk of kidney failure. Moderate risk was 2 to less than 6%. And then high risk was 6% or greater risk of kidney failure in 5 years by the KFRE. And then we looked at whether or not an individual's baseline kidney failure risk modified the comparative effectiveness of SGLT2 versus GLP-1s. We also did the pairwise comparisons for insulin. And what we found was that in the moderate risk group, that 2 to less than 6% KFRE, GLP-1s appeared more favorable for protection against kidney failure or MACE or the CKM composite outcomes. Whereas in people with a higher baseline kidney failure risk, SGLT2 was favored over GLP-1 for protection against all of those outcomes.
Yeah, I find this really fascinating figure as well, and mirrors a little bit of what was seen in prior groups where this SGLT2 inhibitors seems to have a preferential sort of action to reduce kidney failure risk more so than cardiovascular compared to GLP-1. And so I agree, this is really fascinating to think about this and to understand more about how this works. One of the things I'm thinking about with this is, you know, when you have a patient in clinic, how much should we be thinking about these sorts of questions versus more of the practical questions of weight loss, glucose control? How do we put it all together when we see a patient? Because now we're sort of just adding more and more possibilities in our mind to think about which ones to start with.
So weight loss and glucose control, those blood pressure control, those are extremely important. But at the end of the day, what matters hopefully more to the patient is the risk of kidney failure, risk of cardiac events, and all-cause death. And so we do need to think about those. And I think for most patients and clinicians, those are front and center of what they're thinking about. And looking at this figure, so those in the low risk group, what is, that's about 95% of the data. And that's the reality that most people type 2 diabetes are not at very high risk for kidney failure. In that population, which is a majority of type 2 diabetes, they're both SGLT and GLP-1 are comparable. In those at pretty high risk of kidney failure, SGLT is probably preferred. The moderate group, as the accompanying editorial is saying, that's an interesting question, whether that may be the group where we need randomized controlled trials comparing SGLT and GLP-1 to figure out who should be started on those medications. But they also provide some guidance.
Yeah, in a nephrology clinic, though, most of our patients likely is in that moderate to high risk category where we're sort of thinking about these decisions. But you know, as time goes on, more and more patients, by the time they get to us, are already on SGLT2 inhibitor. You're adding a GLP-1. One of the things that strikes me as the kind of elephant in the room here is that 50% of patients on GLP-1 receptor agonist are unable to tolerate them after 1 year. And that's, I don't think, is true for SGLT2 inhibitors. They'll can tolerate them for many, many, many years. So how do you factor that into this discussion about the ability to take these GLP-1 receptor agonists for long durations? We don't really know that sort of question.
You're speaking to my heart, Dr. Sparks. So that's what a lot of my current research is on long-term adherence and discontinuation. Actually, in supplemental figure 8, so we have a graph of discontinuation of SGLT2 and GLP-1 agents over time in this study. And they both had a pretty notable discontinuation rate. It wasn't just GLP-1s. There's really a hole in the literature that we need to look into. We have these new drugs that are life-saving and prevent kidney failure and heart attacks, and it's not any good if people can't take them for the long term. So that's definitely a future direction. And it's okay. It's a problem not just for these agents, but just medications in general. I'm hoping as affordability improves, that might change in the future.
One of the things I really like about this paper is the treasure trove of information about both of these classes of drugs and the largest healthcare system in the United States. And I think that is also just an amazing resource that you all have provided for the nephrology community. What are the next steps that you and your group have to answer some of these fundamental questions we have about goal-directed medical therapy in patients with CKD?
We live in an era of, say, abundance of these drugs. Okay, we had nothing before. So 5-10 years ago, and since then, they just exploded. It's not only the medications, but also advances in methodology as well as informatics that makes it possible to do this kind of research. And so these are exciting times, and there's a lot to be done regarding the optimization of these agents in CKD. We touch base about what combination, what sequence, when, who benefits the most, who is harmed, how do we improve adherence if people just take it only for 3 years, and is it going to improve their outcome long term, and where do MRA fit into all these things? So there's a lot more to be done.
I think people with type 2 diabetes still suffer a higher rate of mortality than those without. And this highlights, you know, some low-hanging fruit, I think, especially on policy and accessibility for SGLT2s and GLP-1s. Compared to insulin, insulin had a over 50% higher risk of mortality compared to either of them. And this is in the overall cohort, which, as we've mentioned, is a lot of lower risk kidney failure patients who are seen by general practice. They're not even maybe making it to nephrology clinic yet. So this has pretty wide-ranging general practice points, I think, for trying to get people onto these agents rather than just sticking them on insulin as well.
And that's an important point. So it's not only about using these agents, but also not using other agents which might be harmful. So a lot of work needs to be done on that.
100%. Well, thank you both so much for coming to the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast and also for your work in this important area. Thanks to the listeners. We look forward to our next episode, which also will be focusing on CKM. And thanks, everyone. Have a great rest of your day. We'll be talking about a paper in CJSN titled Predicting Risk of Cardiovascular Disease Events Equation for Adverse Cardio-Kidney Outcomes in CKD Population. We're joined by the senior author, Dr. Taehwan Yu. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It is a great honor and pleasure to be here. My name is Taehwan Yu. I am a nephrologist and professor at Yonsei University College of Medicine in South Korea. I take care of patients with all types of kidney disease. In my remaining time, I mainly do translational research and epidemiological research related to the kidney disease. I also work with NOCKD and one of collaborators in NOCKD. NOCKD is a large prospective ongoing cohort study of CKD patients in Korea since 2011. For a long time, my team has been interested in the connection between the heart and the kidney. That is why we did this study. We have a good chance to work together with the CRIC team in the United States. And beyond this study, we are still actively sharing data with the CRIC team. This ongoing collaboration continues to give us meaningful results.
That's great. So we can kind of look at the NOCKD or KNOWCKD as the CRIC equivalent in South Korea. Is that correct?
Yeah, right. That's right.
That's great. Well, there is a lot of interest in the connection between the heart and the kidney. And I think this is a perfectly timed paper. The other thing that's confusing for nephrologists is there's so many equations to predict events. It's a little overwhelming to figure out which one to use, which one's better. So maybe we can first start about talking about these equations. The new kid on the block is called PREVENT, and you are going to compare this to several other equations. Can you talk about those equations and, you know, why did we need a new equation?
Originally, the two old tools include the PCE and the SCORE2. The PCE is in U.S., development in U.S., and the SCORE2 is developed in European country. Their scoring system includes the many clinical factors to predict the 10-year risk for cardiovascular disease. However, the death equation is not include the kidney factors like kidney function or albuminuria. The PREVENT CVD score includes the estimated GFR and albuminuria. Their equation can more precisely predict the cardiovascular risk rather than the PCE or SCORE2 system.
What exactly are we trying to predict in these patients, and when would we use it?
Its early detection system is important to stratify the patient to predict the high risk. So the 10-year the risk events can predict by this equation. The PCE and SCORE2 can predict the 10-year risk, but their limitation has no the kidney factors.
If I'm hearing this correctly, you need a patient with risk of cardiovascular disease, not already having cardiovascular disease.
Yes, right.
So if you're seeing a patient that has not had an event, say a heart attack or revascularization, that's the type of person that you would want to consider this equation on. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
And the other thing I just want to, before we move on to the paper and look at it, how it performs in these two groups of patients, is try to understand a little about all these variables, because you see the PREVENT has several different inputs you can put into it, some of which include GFR and albuminuria, and some do not.
The old tools include the clinical factors like age, gender and hypertension and diabetes, and also some smoking status. So there, the scoring system has some prediction system, but the only things is no the kidney factors. In the American Heart Association reported the prevent CVD score can more effectively predict the 10-year cardiovascular risk in general population.
For our listeners, it might not be as familiar. What is CRIC and NO-CKD, and how are those used for these tools?
So the CRIC code is developed in US from 2003. The NO-CKD has very similar way because the NO-CKD has the CRIC in a model. So their clinical characteristics is very similar. We used the two data in two different court. So we adopted this scoring system in these two cohorts.
So these two cohorts have been in existence for over 10 years.
Mm-hmm, right.
Thus, you can do the equation earlier on in their lives and then see if it was actually true.
Right. That's right.
That's very powerful. And that's also great that NO-CKD sort of is modeled after CRIC. So you have very similar parameters measured, but completely different populations of patients, one being CRIC, the United States, and one being NO-CKD, South Korea.
Yeah, that's right.
How many participants are in both of these cohorts?
So a total of 3,940 participants in CRIC and 2,238 participants in NO-CKD. And we excluded the previous cardiovascular disease and no variables we excluded. And then finally, 4,268 participants included in this study.
So it looks like you want to take both these cohorts, exclude people that already had evident cardiovascular disease. So you could really only do these equations on participants that were at risk of cardiovascular disease.
Exactly.
So that's great. Let's move through and talk about how the study was performed. How do you compare these equations?
We used two large prospective cohorts, CRIC, in the US between 2003 and 2008, NO-CKD in Korea between 2011 and 2016. These two studies were designed in a very similar way. NO-CKD cohort was designed around 2011 using CRIC as a model. However, there are a few small differences. For example, NO-CKD includes patients with polycystic kidney disease and chronic glomerulonephritis. For each patient, we calculated several 10-year risk scores. Our main score was prevent CVD. This score predicts both atherosclerotic CVD disease and heart failure. We also calculated prevent ASCVD, which only predicts atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. And we calculated the two older scoring system, pooled cohort equation PCE and score 2. So we could compare them. Finally, we calculated a special version, prevent CVD UACR, which also includes a factor of albuminuria. Our main outcome was CKO, is cardio kidney outcome. This includes 4-point major adverse cardiovascular events. That means heart attack, stroke, hospital admission for heart failure, or death from a heart problem. It also includes MAKE, major adverse kidney events. This means either the estimated GFR dropped by 50% or the patient progressed to dialysis or kidney transplantation. Based on prevent CVD score, we divided the patient into four risk groups, low, borderline, intermediate, and high. First, we analyzed the CKO events across prevent risk groups. And then we compared that each score could predict outcomes. To evaluate the performance of each score, we used heredity statistics, the IDI, and the continuous NRI. We also performed the sensitivity analysis separately in those kid group, Asian, Black, and White population.
Let's take a look at how did this predict it. So you have the patients, you put them into the different groups. How well was this actually predicting true outcomes?
We performed the hazard ratio analysis predicting cardiovascular disease. Compared to lower group, the borderline group is increased 60% increased risk, and then intermediate group twofold higher, and high group is fivefold higher the events in the cardiovascular disease.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. And that is looking at the outcome that you talked about called cardio-kidney outcome?
Mm-hmm. Right, that's right. The composite cardio-kidney outcomes.
And just to be clear, though, these equations were really meant to just look at cardiovascular disease risk. And yeah. This is also including the kidney outcomes as well. So that's kind of a new twist on these equations.
Yes. Originally, the prevent score is developed for detection of the cardio-kidney metabolic, the CKM syndrome. And then in this analysis, we also analyzed the CKO first, and then separately the four-point MACE and MAKE. And all-cause mortality.
Let's move on to the equations. I think that's what we're all here for.
You know? Okay.
How did these equations compare, and how much better, or is the prevent better than PCE and score 2?
That's a very complicated story. Simply, the first result is prevent CVD was clearly better than the PCE and score 2 for predicting the combined cardio-kidney outcome. For kidney outcome only, the prevent was strongly better than the old tools, but the 4-point MACE and prevent was still slightly better, but only small difference. For example, its advantage over PCE for MACE was very small. And the second result is about albuminuria. When we used the prevent CVD UACR, the prediction became even better. This was especially true for the combined outcome and for kidney outcomes. This makes biologically sense because albuminuria is a very important marker of kidney health. So this finding supports that adding albuminuria really helps when predicting heart and kidneys together.
Well, we as nephrologists have albuminuria on every one of our patients, and so you're speaking to the choir here on that. I'm hopeful, though, that this result will permeate into the cardiology sphere and primary care sphere so that UACR is incorporated more.
Yeah, sometimes some physicians did not order the albuminuria in routine practice. There, the laboratory findings cannot include it in that situation.
So not only it might be useful in improving the equation, it's also useful in flagging this individual as being high risk for both cardiovascular and kidney outcomes.
Mm, yeah.
So independent of its use in the equation, it's still, I think, very valuable.
In the nephrologist view, the albuminuria is not only the risk factor, and also, but also we have to reduce the albuminuria by some measurement, kind of some drugs or the change the lifestyle management. We can reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease in treatment of albuminuria.
100%. We have the tools to target as well. So what's next for this area? And are we ready now to be predicting and using this score on every patient we see built into the EMR?
We can easily calculate this equation in some Google or some other's internet.
But also just having it right there on the patient's chart would be great to have that.
Yeah, that's right. I understand. Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah.
Well, what's the next area of investigation for you and your group looking at predicting cardiovascular disease? Is this it, the last equation, or do we have more?
Yeah, but we still have some limitation in this study because I hope the further development of a new score in only the CKD patient, especially in advanced CKD, because in advanced CKD, heart disease has different characteristics, including traditional and non-traditional risk factors, including vascular calcification and mineral disorders. So a score designed for this reality could be very powerful and give some help to stratify CVD risk in CKD patients. So we need only in CKD patient group, the scoring system.
Great. Well, thank you so much to you and your group. It's been really a pleasure to speak with you about your paper. Mm-hmm. And thank you also to the listeners to the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. We hope to see you here next time.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.